It's an amazing piece of literature, John's Gospel. And it was when I came back to the church in my early 20s, we actually formed a small Bible study, and this was the book that we read from and studied. And I found it amazing then, and then I kind of got worried about it because it seemed so different to the other Gospels. I don't know if you've ever tried to write a book. Has anybody tried to write a novel? If you do write a novel, there's a rule, they say, for writers. That is that you describe, don't tell. So when you're writing about a character in a good novel, they don't say, for instance, that Bill was angry. All right, you don't tell us. You say, Bill's face grew red and his narrow-eyed bored into me. Right? Does that make sense? So you don't actually say, Bill is angry. You describe. And that's the way the synoptic gospels are. And when I say synoptic gospels, I mean those first three gospels, who are all quite similar. Not exactly the same, but all quite similar in the way they tell stories about Jesus. And we infer, speaking of words, there's two words that lots of people mess up, infer and imply. We infer, you imply, and I infer from what you said. So we infer from that what the character of Jesus, trying to understand the character of Jesus. Now, John's gospel is different because he doesn't just tell stories about Jesus, although if you've read John's gospel a lot, you'll find one of the interesting things is he has these very long conversations. And one of the most famous ones is in John 3, right, with Nicodemus. Which leads to that famous verse that we all know so well, John 3:16. But John also tells us, actually, John tells us what it means. And he has something to say about that. And so I stopped worrying about John and I just enjoyed it as an extraordinary piece of literature. And what I liked about it was trying to imagine when John wrote it. So we know, in fact, the earliest, this is just as an aside, the oldest papyrus, existing papyrus, that has the words of a gospel printed on it comes from John's gospel. And it's a little fragment from John, and it is in a museum in Manchester. And it's a very famous papyrus. It dates from the year 125. And it was found in Egypt. So we know that John's gospel was found, had made its way to Egypt by 125. And we know that other people were writing about having read his gospel from about 130, the year 130 onwards. And most people think, and it seems to be true, that this gospel was written at the end of the first century, well after the other gospels were written, because it seems to speak into a different context. One of the things that's different is that by the end of the first century is that Christians have been put out of the Jewish synagogues. At first they were just regarded as a sect of Judaism, but by the end of the century they've been put out of the Jewish synagogues. And I like to think that John, who was his disciple of Jesus, one of the youngest disciples perhaps, so Jesus is 30, right, so perhaps John's 20, a young man. So as he writes this in AD 90, he's 80 years old. And somebody said, John, you're getting on, buddy. You need to write down what you know about Jesus. And I just imagine him there as this old man reflecting on this most exciting, the most awesome period of his life. You see, he's seen the coming Messiah. He's seen the coming of the Messiah. He's seen the one and only who's full of grace and truth. And perhaps by now he's the last of the disciples on earth, of the original 12. And so he sets out to tell this story and he goes big. I don't know if you noticed the way he started this story. What does he say? He says, in the beginning. Now last week Lisa read to us those exact words. Where did they come from? The very first book of the Bible, very first verse of the Bible, Genesis 1. In the beginning. And this is how John starts. He said, in the beginning was the Word. This idea of the word, it's a Greek word, logos, as we talked about earlier. It doesn't just mean some letters that when said have a particular meaning. It's this idea of message. And it's the word that underpins words we still have in English, like eulogy and monologue and dialogue, all of those things. So it's this idea of this message, this word, this message from God. And not only that, this idea that it was an eternal word. In the beginning was the Word, and in him was life, and that life was the light of all humankind. John wants to know this right at the start. And I guess when we read through Scripture and we think about starting at the beginning and reading through it, we'd say that the Old Testament kind of starts really well. First chapter, good, Garden of Eden. God looked at it. It was good. It's all great. Then the fall, right? And it doesn't get a lot better from there on. In fact, it might say that it gets worse, right? All kinds of things go down. And by the time you've finished Malachi, you're thinking, this isn't a happy story. But then it all changes when we get into the New Testament. And in the New Testament, we have this sense of the glory of God. So there's lots of theology in this first chapter that we're reading here. And I think we can infer the hope and the wonder and awe that John felt as he wrote this. This is a message of hope and love, of light and life made manifest. John's world had changed, and the whole world had changed, and it's personal. And although he's writing years later, you can hear sometimes the sadness in his voice when he says his own did not receive him. And we think, of course, that that's the people of Israel, the Jews who did not receive him. But there's always an upside to this, because he can't stay unhappy long. He says, to those who believed, he gave the right to become children of God. Tells us of Jesus, full of grace and truth. And from his fullness, we have received grace upon grace. That's the word. The word that flows through this passage, the word grace. And that grace that was only glimpsed again and again in the Old Testament, which has so many unhappy stories, is fully revealed in the New Testament, and it's revealed in Jesus. And that is because Jesus is really here, the Word made flesh. Jesus is here in person, as a real person, as a human being. You see, to be a Christian is to believe in what we call the incarnation. That is that God became flesh. The God who is outside time places Jesus, the only begotten Son, as a real human person, right in the middle of history. And we would say that he was always going to do so. Sometimes we imagine that Jesus was Plan D, right? And I think when I first read the Bible, I thought that's what was going on here. Right, so Jesus had Plan A, Adam and Eve, didn't work out. Then he tried again with Noah, didn't work out. Then he tried again with the children of Israel, didn't work out. All right, Plan D, I'll send Jesus. That's not really the way it works, right? Jesus was God's plan all along. Jesus was never a backstop if everything else failed. Jesus was and is the eternal Word, the one and only Son, and he has come, and we have seen his glory, John says. Now, because our minds are small and finite, we understand time as linear, right? It just progresses in one line. And so sometimes we say, it's not wrong to say it, that Christianity is descended from Abraham, like to other religions. And we'd say, yes, Abraham is a common ancestor and is an example to us. In fact, Jesus talks about Abraham. But Christianity starts with Jesus. It's an eternal moment that begins at a particular point in history that stretches backwards in time and forward in time. And Abraham's story is rewritten. In fact, Jesus would go on to say this really cryptic thing where he says later that Abraham rejoiced to see my day. And it's this idea of the eternal Word who recasts history. History is reinvented. Do you know that moment where you get a piece of information that helps you suddenly make sense of what was going on in the past? I was looking this up. I was trying to find a great example. And I'm not sure I did, but I did come across people who misheard lyrics. You know, someone had thought that Bob Dylan was singing "The Ants Are My Friends" and "Blowing in the Wind." It was not about the ants, my friends. The most famous, of course, is Phoebe from Friends, the show Friends. Do you know that one? "Hold Me Close Now, Tony Danza." You don't know who Tony Danza is and you've never watched Friends, that's not going to be nearly as meaningful for you. So I knew that I couldn't use those examples, right? Has anybody ever seen the movie The Truman Show? Okay. So The Truman Show is a movie and the main character is Jim Carrey, and he kind of has this extraordinary life, and he doesn't realise that his life is taking place on a massive TV set, and everybody in his life is an actor. Everybody throughout his whole life have been actors. And finally, is anybody planning to watch it? Because I am going to spoil it just a little bit, right? Gradually he works out, it doesn't seem to make sense, and gradually he works out that he is in fact on a movie set. And once he finds that out, everything changes. His whole conception of the world, his whole understanding of everything changes. And that's what happens in Jesus. When Jesus comes, and we're talking about this with some of the guys on Friday morning. When Jesus comes, we look even at Scripture differently. We look at the Old Testament differently. And we ask ourselves that great question, what would Jesus do? And we see the Old Testament, we see those stories differently, right? Jesus changes the future. We ask ourselves, what would Jesus do? And we know because we have seen him. With Jesus, the eternal living incarnate word, everything changes, including history, including the future. Christianity starts with Jesus. Jesus in the flesh, a human being like us, but also God. And it means something. Now, Christians literally fought about this. They used to have protests in the street, then ended up in fist fights. Because some people said, yeah, Jesus is not the eternal word. He was created by God. He's a created being. And they marched down the street saying, there was when he was not. There was when he was not. And all the people who believed in the eternal word, they'd get their protest signs out and they'd say, he's one with the Father, one in essence. And they'd have fist fights about it. In the end, they had to have a church council about it. And everybody argued about it for days and days. And they reaffirmed as orthodoxy that Jesus Christ was truly and properly God and truly and properly man. We have those words in the doctrines of the Salvation Army and all orthodox Christian churches, that he really was God, but he really was a human being as well. And if that's the case, it means something, right? It means that life itself is good. That Jesus Christ, coming as a human being, shows us that the world of physical existence is good. It's God's affirmation of our humanity. Sometimes Christians have thought that it's only the spiritual life that really matters. That the physical life, the flesh as it's called in the Bible, is secondary, that doesn't matter. So people would punish their flesh or ignore their bodies or starve themselves to be more spiritual. No. To be human is to be good. The incarnation is an affirmation of that. God looked at his creation and it was good, and we are good. And so we should enjoy doing good human things. We should enjoy other people in our lives. We should enjoy meals with friends. We should enjoy art. We should enjoy stories. We should enjoy creation. We should enjoy the simple pleasures of life. Because in Jesus, God's goodness is revealed. His becoming like us is part of his love for us. John goes on to say, out of his fullness, we have received grace upon grace. That's literally what it says there. It's a little bit different in the translation in our Bibles. We receive grace upon grace. This idea that in Jesus, God gives and gives and gives again. Jesus, full of grace and truth, who came and lived among us, and we have seen his glory. When I was a young man, the Salvation Army used to have these big youth gatherings, and they were what they used to call tri-territorial, right? There were two Australian territories, and then we'd invite the Kiwis as well. So there were these massive youth rallies, and one of them back in 1984, we invited a guy who would later become the general of the Salvation Army, John Gowans, out. And he spoke, and he was an amazing speaker, right? And it's probably one of the few sermons I remember from the 80s or the 90s or the noughties, really, when I started preaching. It just stuck in my mind. He said, you know, because in the Salvation Army what they do is if when you go to Bible college, they give you a session a name. And normally it's meant to be a spiritual name, and for most people it is. Mine wasn't, unfortunately. Because we were going to graduate in 2000, they called us Forward 2000. And so we were called the Forwards, which I've always played in the Forwards, so it didn't matter that much, I guess. But John Gowan said, if I was ever to name a session, and little did he know that he would, he would said, I would call it the Becomers. This idea that God gave us the power to become his children. He gave us the right to become his children. This process of becoming a child of God, this right to become a child of God, what an extraordinary thing. And the eternal creator God of the universe calls you and me his children, that we are his daughters and his sons. That's an extraordinary thought. That's grace. That's grace upon grace. Grace that transcends the law. Christianity is not about making a decision to be a Christian and then following the rules. We know that, don't we? That's not what it's about. At the heart of this Christian thing is a relationship with our Creator God, who loves us, and we know he loves us because of Jesus. And so we believe in the human and the divine Jesus. It's Jesus that shapes our life together, shapes our goals and our plans. Jesus is not just a really nice bloke, the founder of Christianity, a Christian movement. He's not a holy man who gave us good thoughts to ponder. Jesus is the eternal Word, the Word of God. He is light and truth. He is God made flesh. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. He is the living God and the truest reality. And we marvel at that. We recognize that we don't fully understand it. We are humbled by it. But above all, we believe. We believe in Jesus. We believe that in Jesus we know God. To be a Christian is to believe that on the dusty hills of Palestine 2,000 years ago, God himself walked among us, and that as the risen and exalted Christ, he walks among us still. We are never alone. Never. God is with us. We may be lonely, but we are never alone. We may be lost, but we are never alone. Jesus is here. Our world has changed, and we need to live as if that is true. We are Jesus' people, the best part of God's creation, loved by God, children of God. He wants us to know him. We can see him in Jesus. And if all of that is true, we must do something about it. We must live as if God has come. Live as if Jesus is in our lives. Live as if we too, just like John, have beheld the glory of God's one and only, full of grace and truth. Jesus is here, and we can never be the same. He's here with us now, in this moment, the living Christ among his people.